You're listening to episode 115 of the Tennis Files podcast with special guest Todd Whittem.
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at newbalance.com.
Welcome to the Tennis Files podcast, bringing you advice from the top minds in tennis to help you improve your game. And now, here's your host, Mehrban Iranshad.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the Tennis Files podcast. My name is Mehrban Iranshad, a former Division I college tennis player, and on the podcast, I interview the best coaches, pros and experts to help you improve your tennis game. And today I had the privilege of interviewing Todd Whittem, who was a former top 200 ATP pro and obviously a fantastic junior player. And he's transitioned to private coaching, where he has a small, very fantastic elite group of junior players that he fully develops, you know, their game and even takes care of a lot of other things, almost to the point of being like a father to his students, as you'll find out in the podcast episode. And so if you want to learn about what it takes to be a successful junior, some of the ups and downs of the career of Todd as a professional tennis player, and just in general, you know, what traits are essential to be a successful tennis player in person, then I think this will be a fantastic episode for you. We definitely talked for a while, and I'm really thankful to Todd for the time he gave, but every minute was very valuable and gave some really great insights and tips that I think you'll really enjoy. And it's always really special to have people like Todd on, who not only can give you a really cool and interesting and helpful glimpse into the life of a great junior player and a top level professional player, but also then his insights on what it takes to become a great coach. So it's almost like he's covering the whole spectrum, really, of tennis players and coaches and things to learn. So really enjoyed it. Todd is also a pro at podcasts. He's too humble to admit, but he's been on several, including Lisa Stone's podcast as well, I believe Parenting Aces. So anyways, really cool to have Todd on. And, you know, with that intro, I think it's time to get on with it and go to the interview. So without further ado, here is my interview with Todd Whittem. Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Tennis Files podcast. I'm really honored to have former ATP pro and current tennis coach Todd Whittem to talk about how he has been able to develop elite junior players in a non-academy setting. Just to give you a bit of a background on Todd, he was, and actually still is, according to the videos I see, a great player. So he was a former top 200 ATP pro in both singles and doubles. Todd was also a two-time All-American at the University of Miami, and he was a former 18 and under Super National champion. Well, I guess I'll always live with you, so you're a champ there. And he's also the owner of TW Tennis, which is South Florida's top small group slash private tennis training academy. Well, not an academy, but a place where he trains very elite junior tennis players and has had many results with the students that I think, you know, surpass in many ways what academies have produced. So, Todd, really appreciate you coming on to the podcast, and thanks so much for joining me today.
Well, thanks, Mehrban. Thanks so much for that great introduction. I'm excited to have a great show with you.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Todd. Me too. And like I said, I mean, I've really been impressed. You know, I've noticed you on some coaching groups on Facebook, or at least maybe one of them, and I've seen you post, you know, all these amazing videos of your students just playing against like tour pros, you know, like Ronnie that we just talked about before the recording, and many others, and really some fantastic results have been posted. And as I researched you more and more, I just thought that you'd be a fantastic guest for the show. Just an opening question for you, Todd. So I've noticed that you start very many of your Facebook posts about your students with the words, "not a tennis academy." And I was wondering, you know, what this means to you and you know, why do you always tend to post that as some as a reminder to everybody?
Absolutely. So what I've seen in South Florida and what I've heard about throughout the country and if not the world is that there's tennis academies. And so I would consider a tennis academy maybe more of a public schooling system where they take on many different players, could be different mentalities, a lot of different age groups, a lot of different coaches, just kind of more of a mishmash of all kinds of all kinds of, you know, like I said, players, mentalities, coaches, you know, a lot of different stuff. So I consider what I do, I would consider it as an elite private schooling for tennis. Mm-hmm. And so the kids and the students that you've seen in maybe my videos on social media or you know, basically, yeah, my social media posts is that they've gone through a very thorough assessment, just like any child would do if they were going to school and into an elite private school. And I look at everything, obviously their techniques, their movements, how they may construct points, all these different things. And most importantly, their mentality and work ethic. So then I decide whether they'd be a great candidate for my private schooling. So that's why I say it's not a tennis academy. And so in my little private system, I brought in the coach that has been one of the most well-respected coaches in South Florida for almost four decades. And he was also the coach that trained me from when I was 6 years old to when I retired from the ATP Tour at 26 years old. And so my upbringing in tennis, I was around a lot of amateur and professional champions from when I was 6 years old. So I was trained by two very well-known disciplinarian Argentine coaches. Their names were George Paris and Pierre Arnold. And Pierre Arnold is the one that is with me every single day. I brought him in. He was really a fatherhood figure for me. And I was also trained by his best friend and partner, George Paris. Unfortunately, George Paris passed away when I was 15 years old. So it was a very tough time for Pierre and obviously for the students. But it was just an incredible tennis upbringing, and you were around so many champions and around, you know, very tough competitors and intensity and work ethic and discipline. And it was just a really incredible time. So what I've tried to do is I've tried to hand select kids that I really want to put my daily hours into every single day. And so when you look at the social media posts that I put out there, these are the children that I really love to be with every single day, and they've gone through this very thorough assessment, and obviously they've passed it, and that's why they're here in my system. So in my system, I have my full-timers that are with me all the time. Actually, most of them have moved to the Coral Springs area, which is the western part of Fort Lauderdale. They've moved here from outside the area, and then I also have a pretty good following of kids throughout the country and even a couple international students that come in when they can during maybe their spring break or Christmas break, those types of breaks that want to come in for some great training.
That's fantastic, Todd. And I think that it's really wonderful because you're basically getting to pick the students who you really like kind of jive with your values and your attitudes that you want to see. And so I think that's a great way to really, you know, enjoy and feed off of each other's passion like that. So that's wonderful. I was wondering too, you know, of course you coach a small group. So, I mean, is there like a range of students that you try to keep, you know, a number of?
Yeah, sure. So in my system, like I said, I have Pierre Arnold who trained me for 20 years, from when I was 6 to 26 years old. So it's Pierre and I, and we do all the coaching. And then I hire private hitting partners as well. So the system is very small. It's very private. The max amount of students that I take on are 12 students, and that's it. So in the summer, for example, I was full with 12 students every single week. And I had a waiting list, which is very exciting for me. But some people were trying to get in and you know, do some assessments with Pierre and I and see if they'd be a great fit. But they had to wait a little bit. depending on when I had availability. So that's an exciting, you know, that's exciting for me because I started this small private system really with one player in 2010. So I've been doing this since the summer of 2010. But like I said, you know, I've always wanted to do it the right way. I haven't wanted to take on kids that I didn't enjoy and didn't want to be with every single day. And I was raised and brought up by not only my parents, but also from Pierre and George that if we're going to do it, we're going to do it right. And I think the parents and the students very much understand that. And so there's a certain standard that we expect every single day. And really for the kids in my system, we manage everything. So it could be obviously their tennis and their physical fitness and maybe their tournament scheduling. And so it's a whole management of their tennis careers. And then on top of that, when they're ready for college placement, I'm the one who gets on the computer as well as the students. And I start making phone calls to the colleges that I think would be a great fit for that particular child. And so that's a really important part as well, as to make sure that they're placed properly in college based on their academic and their tennis results.
That's amazing. You're not only looking after their tennis career, but really their future in life with that type of service. So that's wonderful. I was wondering too, before we get into, you know, kind of the beginnings of your career, which is, you know, well, it's all pretty interesting. I was wondering maybe what's one lesson that you learned from George?
Well, you know, maybe the viewers may have heard his name, George Parris, but he was just such a well-respected coach in the area, but he was very tough. And he reminded me a lot. I got to spend a couple of days with Robert Lansdorp in California. And Robert, it really reminded me so much of George when I went out to spend a couple of days with Robert. And so just the standard that these coaches and the professionalism that they brought every single day to the courts was just unmatched. I rarely ever have seen it since. And the passion that they brought, they were, like I said, they were Argentine coaches, and the passion and the love that they had for their students was just incredible. And they really loved to be out there with you. And you could tell it was the energy, the intensity, the passion for wanting to really help these children, and not just help them with their tennis, which they produce so many phenomenal champions, like I said, amateur and professional, but it was to really help you in your life. And so I'm still in contact with many of the kids that were brought up with Pierre and George. And we speak about how many of those amazing life lessons that we learned, from the discipline to the work ethic and how to compete, and just so many lessons that we learned through tennis, but by having such amazing mentors and coaches. And it was just really an incredible time, and it was just incredible lessons that we learned.
That's wonderful stuff, Todd, and you're clearly carrying on, you know, their legacy, well, at least George's legacy, and you're heavily influenced by those coaches, and that's great. And so this is always an interesting answer to hear from me to this question, but what is your first memory of hitting a tennis ball?
My first memory of hitting a tennis ball, well, you see, my father was a phenomenal golfer. He was a scratch player in college, and my mom was into tennis. So I was introduced actually to both sports when I was about 6 years old. And so my father was a member of the Country Club of Coral Springs, which is actually where I train my students now. So I really haven't gone too far. So I was introduced to both sports. And I remember being in clinics with a lot of kids and just really loving tennis. And the coach that introduced me to tennis, this man, Sean Craig, just had an incredible amount of energy. And he was just so phenomenal with the recreational side of kids and adults. And so that really gave me, you know, really gave me the love for tennis at a pretty young age.
Awesome. That's great stuff. And I mean, you know, along with that, did you have any tennis idols while you were growing up and playing in the early stages of your life?
Well, I can tell you, yeah, but it's not really a very famous name, even though I'm sure a lot of your listeners would know this man. But like I said, I was brought up, you know, by Pierre and George, you know, in their academy and everything. And so one of the big time players that was training there was Jay Berger. Mm-hmm. And so I watched him training all the time. You could consider him the David Ferrer of the 80s and 90s with the intensity and the work ethic and the drive. And so, like I said, that's how the kids were brought up and, you know, that were working with George and Pierre. And so he was really one of my idols growing up. And so it was incredible. I just watch in awe at such a young age, 6, 7, 8 years old, and watch him train and see what he was doing and try to bring that intensity to my lesson. So, for example, I'd watch George training Jay Berger in a 2-hour workout. And then at 6 or 7 years old, I'd go take my half hour lesson. But Jay being a really good person and being great to the kids in the academy, he would hit in my lessons quite often. Yeah. And so it was just an incredible environment. And really that's the way that I was brought up as well, is that you play with everyone. And so as a favor to George, because George had spent so many years developing Jay, so Jay would give back to hitting in my lessons when I was a youngster. And not only that, who became my college coach at the University of Miami? Jay Berger. So, and then now Jay Berger trains Riley Opelka. And so I bring my student Ronnie Homan up to West Palm Beach to train with Riley Opelka and Jay Berger. So it has been a long lasting relationship there, and it's been great. And just, you know, my tennis upbringing was just really incredible when I look back on it. And really the students that are in my system, I try to deliver and give them, you know, many things that were given to me at a very young age.
Wonderful. And yeah, I mean, I'm looking right now, you know, Jay, for those of you who don't know, I mean, he's beaten players like Mats Wilander, Boris Becker, Stefan Edberg. So clearly an incredible player. And speaking of Jay, I mean, I was actually reading some, I guess you could say, older articles about you. And I read in an Orange Bowl article from 2001 that Jay said that you had one of the best down-the-line backhands that he had ever seen. And so he's quoted there with that statement. And so what's the key in your estimation to having a great down-the-line backhand?
Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, some things may come easier to some players. I mean, you have to understand that when you're brought up by a disciplinarian coach who's really invested in these players, the workouts were really tough and there were tons of repetitions every single day. Mm-hmm. So the lessons were grueling and very tough with a lot of reps at a very young age. So you develop so many things and so many different tools that you were going to use for your whole tennis career. So people know me as having a great backhand down the line, which is great to have, obviously. But you know, that was developed at a very young age. And in the lessons with George, I can tell you, you know, from when I was, you know, like I said, 7, 8 years old, that he would tell me to go cross court more, but I love to rip it down the line. Mm-hmm. So you know, some things are maybe just more natural than others.
Yeah, sure. That makes a lot of sense, Todd. And so you were obviously a top junior and you were dominating. So I was wondering if you could kind of tell us, like, in your view, like, what skills or traits did you possess? And I know you've talked about, you know, hard work, but what traits or maybe tennis skills did you possess that really allowed you to be a top junior player when most other kids were maybe distracted at the time or doing other normal teen stuff?
Sure. Well, tennis for me was, you know, obviously I loved it and the competing and the intensity and the workouts I loved. There were some things that came maybe a little bit easier for me than maybe the majority. I know what I was blessed with. I mean, all good players, whether they're amateur or professionals, there are certain things that maybe come a little bit more natural than others. So I was blessed with good eye-hand coordination and balance of my legs. So, you know, when you start going through your career, you know, and these are the things that I think about quite often as I'm training juniors to go to the most elite colleges and maybe professionals one day. But, you know, at a young age, it was pretty, I wouldn't say easy, but I was able to hit the ball pretty clean. And so that's why Jay Berger kind of, you know, took me under his wing a little bit because he saw that I was a good ball striker. So, you know, I mean, that doesn't mean everything, but you do have to be able to strike the ball clean to be a good player. But for me, it didn't come very easy. I had to really put a lot of work in, and I had to hit a lot of reps every single day in practice. So there are players that maybe it's more natural for them and their strokes and everything, and they don't really have to do a ton of reps. But for me, I had to work extremely hard. I had to hit many, many thousands of balls every single day to feel confident in myself. I had to do a lot of amounts of fitness and first step quickness and endurance training. Quickness for me wasn't so natural, where some kids are just naturally great movers and super fast. I mean, obviously I was fast, but I wasn't, say, David Ferrer fast. So I had to work incredibly hard to try to maximize my movement. I had good balance, but I wasn't incredibly fast. So the way I was trained with the movements and the physical fitness, it was to become as fast as I could and as explosive as I could. But when I look back on my junior career, it took me 10 years to really break through and become an elite player in the United States. So I was working incredibly hard from when I was 6 years old to when I was 16. That's when I really started to break through. I wouldn't say struggling, but I was a good top five, top 10 player in the state of Florida. And I was losing many times to the same players. And I kept struggling with them year after year. And they were great players. But then when I was able to grow and I did mature physically a little bit later than most of the boys that I was competing with. And then when I was able to mature physically and put all these tools together that I had trained for 10 years, that's when I really started to hit my stride. It was about 16 years old.
Gotcha. Gotcha. That's fantastic. And so, I mean, you mentioned obviously everybody has their natural gifts and whatnot, but in terms of playing style, I was curious, like, how were you beating players? Like, what were there specific weapons that you had, or did you rely on speed, or what was it exactly?
Sure. So my whole goal, as well as when George and Pierre were training me, was for me, they knew I was going to become a professional player at some point. It was more of a matter of when, but it was to have a total game where I could grind, I could rip a forehand and backhand, I could transition, I could mix pace, I could go high, heavy, I could go high and softer, I could serve and volley, I could return and come in, because I wasn't going to be 6'4", 6'6", like many of the guys that I competed against. So I'm a little bit under 6 feet tall. And so you have to have a total game. And so we were constantly working on all these different tools for me to succeed. And so many times I had a lot of different game plans based on the opponent that I was going to play. And I'm talking about whether I was in junior tennis, in college tennis, or in professional tennis. And I could just flip the game plan and try to do something else if game plan A or B wasn't working, or whatever the case shall be. And so some of the best wins I can tell you that I had on tour, I had to play game plans that were totally against my what I was naturally good at. But I had worked many hours in practice throughout my whole life on developing so many different skills that I had to bring out many times, say, a lot more serving and volleying than I usually did, or maybe returning and coming in off a player's second serve to put pressure, you know, or mix pace and maybe slice and junk a little bit, or maybe I needed to play bigger because the player could out rally me, out grind me. So I needed to play a little bit more first strike tennis. So I was able to really mix it up and really be able to change my game plans based on really the surface I was playing on and the player I was playing against.
Yeah, I love that. Really, you know, whenever you add a weapon to the toolbox, then you give yourself another way to win matches. In terms of technical development for you, was there any one stroke? And, you know, because people, they struggle with developing their backhand or their serve. Like, was there any one stroke that you struggled with as a junior for like a somewhat substantial amount of time and trying to fix it?
You know, Mirban, I would say really no. Mm-hmm. Because the way I was trained by these two individuals that were such a phenomenal coaches, the foundation was very strong at a young age. So I can tell you that the way that they taught their students was that the technique, whether it was the grip and the swing and the movement, these were all tied into the drills. It wasn't like someone, and I see this all the time, whether it's right or wrong, it's not for me to say, but I see a lot of kids that are maybe, you know, there's videos on the internet and everything that kids are being hand fed and they're just swinging and they're swinging and swinging and swinging. And that was really never part of my development coming through junior tennis. It was always movement, technique. Obviously the grips are set hopefully at a young age and they're proper, but the movement, the technique, the ball placement, how you were hitting the ball, whether it was heavy, angle, flat, through the court with topspin, all these things were set at a young age. You had the toolbox, you had these shots in your arsenal, and it was worked upon every single day by the same coach, and it was solid, and it was a very, very solid foundation.
Gotcha, Todd. So in other words, sometimes you see coaches only hand feeding and focusing on the technique, but then like when they're actually moving and hitting live balls, then they're not really working on it anymore. And then it kind of gets jumbled up.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, and so many, many times, and I can tell you from the students that have come through my door, is that they may look good in drills. They may look good in hand fed or bucket drills, those types of things. But then when you put them in a live ball situation and you put targets down, all of a sudden their movements, their techniques, their racket preparation, their concentration, all these things break down. Mm-hmm. So the foundation is not solid. And so many times, and really for most of the kids that I'm training and have trained, is that we have to work very hard to get that solid foundation so that then they can start producing their desired results in tournaments.
Gotcha, Todd. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I appreciate that. And one thing with when I was looking at that Orange Bowl article, I saw so many names in there that became future pros. And I was wondering, you know, I mean, I know this was a while ago, like 18 years ago, but can you remember who from that tournament, the Orange Bowl that you played, that I think you might have lost in the third round in three sets, but do you like, who do you remember from that tournament that while you were playing, you were thinking, oh, this person is going to be really good in the professional level?
Well, I can tell you there's two guys and I played them in that Orange Bowl. I remember it like it was yesterday.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
So I was already at the University of Miami and after my first semester at UM, I was one of the top college players already. I think I may have been top 10 or top 20 in the country mm-hmm. at that time. So the Orange Bowl was played at Key Biscayne where they used to play the Miami Open. And so I figured, you know, maybe I can try to get a wild card and play because it's right down the street. So I got a wild card. And so in my second round match, I played Janko Tipsarevic mm-hmm. and I knew who he was. He probably had no clue who I was. So because when, like I said, when I started to become pretty good at 16 years old, I had a pretty good Easter Bowl where I finished maybe seventh or eighth in the tournament in the 16 and unders. And the USTA took me on a trip to Europe. And it was a great experience. It was 3 weeks. It was two in Italy and one in France. And they were the top, there were a lot of the top 16 year olds in Europe. And so we went there. There were eight of us on the US team that went there. And I'll never forget. I saw this boy who was sliding around on the clay, ripping the ball, never missing. His legs were huge and strong. And I can tell. And I was top five in the United States ranking wise. And I remember thinking to myself as I was watching him play, I was thinking, I'm not sure I would actually get games off of this kid. and really, not only that, he was a year younger than me. And I was thinking to myself, I need to now train harder. I need to be more disciplined. And if I want to become a professional, I really need to up the standard. And trust me, I was already trained at a pretty high level, to tell you the truth, right? But I needed to never miss any details. You know, don't miss a fitness workout. Nothing. Never can happen ever again. So anyway, so we fast forward a couple of years. And I play Janko Tipsarevic. He's a number two junior in the world. Like I said, I know him. He has no clue who I am. And I had a really big upset. And so I really had never played international tournaments. I only played three ITF tennis tournaments in my junior career. One was the Orange Bowl I'm talking about. One was the U.S. Open, and one was a low-level ITF tournament in Hilton Head, South Carolina. And so Yanka was coming in number two in the world and everything, and I had a huge upset, and I beat him a break in the third. It was a great match. It was very exciting. Obviously, like you said, in the draw, there were a lot of professionals in the making at that time. And so that was super exciting. And then in my next round, I remember Pierre kind of running around asking a lot of his Argentine buddies and coaches, you know, who is this guy Juan Monaco? Who is this guy? And how does he play? And because he really didn't have much of an ITF record either. And so no one, you know, it was hard to find out how he played and come up with a game plan and everything. So anyway, so I end up playing Juan Monaco, you know, an unknown guy. I play him on center court and I lose a break in the third. He kind of wore me down. He was an incredible player. I'm sure a lot of the viewers, you know, watched him play. He retired not too long ago. Mm-hmm. And so I lost a close match to him, but he went on to have a phenomenal career and everything. And so I went back to the University of Miami after that match. And then about a year later, Juan Monaco, the unknown guy that I played in the Orange Bowl, who actually went on to the finals and lost against Robin Soderling in that Orange Bowl. But anyway, so now we fast forward into his professional career. Well, I'm still at the University of Miami, and he's playing a night match against Gustavo Kuerten on center court. So what I'm thinking is, when am I going to turn pro? I need to get out of college. I want to turn pro. I've wanted to be a pro my whole life from when I was 6 years old. And so, you know, so when Pierre and I thought it was the right time, then I turned pro.
There you go. Wow. You're clairvoyant too, Todd, because you basically answered my next question. Well, actually I'm going to rewind, and I was curious too, just, what colleges recruited you, and then how did you end up choosing Miami over the others?
Absolutely. Well, it was really such an easy decision. So at that time there was really no emails and stuff like that. So you'd get a lot of the college recruiting through letters in the mail. Mm-hmm. So I was getting, you know, based on your ranking, you're getting, you know, I mean, I was ranked obviously high. I was one in the country my second year, 18s.
Pretty high.
So you're going to get a lot of letters. You know, the kids today, they get a lot of emails. So it was exciting. I personally didn't love academics. So when Harvard and schools like that and Duke and those types of amazing schools are sending me letters, I was kind of laughing, saying that I would never go to schools like that because I didn't love academics. And the funniest part of it is that the kids that are coming to train with Pierre and I, these are the types of schools that they want to go to. So I have relationships with these coaches, but when I was coming through, I never even considered any of these schools because academics, I really didn't love academics. I would have loved academics a lot more now. When my tennis career was you know, winding down or finished. But when I was coming through junior tennis, the only thing I thought about was, when am I turning pro, and I need to get certain results to be able to be on the professional tour. Mm-hmm. So I got obviously a lot of letters and all those things, but I never took a recruiting trip. And so this is probably going to blow the mind of a lot of the viewers, is that I was number one in the country and I never took a recruiting trip anywhere. So the deal was Pierre went up to Jay Berger and said, you know, he said, you're going to take this kid. He's going to be at University of Miami. We're going to produce this guy into a professional player. It's only 50 miles down the road, and I want us to keep managing Todd's career. And you're going to give him a full scholarship, and that's it. And boom. So that's really how that happened. And so really that's many times, like, for example, that's what I did with Ronnie. Was I did the research for Ronnie, and for the viewers that don't know, Ronnie Holman was the number one college recruit in the country, and he's been living with my family and I for probably about 4.5 years. Mm-hmm. And he's really part of my family. And if you look at my social media, I have a lot of clips on Ronnie and those types of things. We're very proud of what he accomplished. And so I did the research for him, and I wanted him to go to University of Miami to be in the same scenario of what I was in. When, you know, with Jay Berger at UM and with Pierre, but unfortunately they didn't have any scholarship money. So the next best option was to go to LSU. and play for Andy Brandy, who has been one of the most well-respected coaches and a guy that Pierre and I have known. He's been coaching longer than Pierre, and I grew up with his son, and we have a great relationship, and we're communicating all the time about how to be producing Ronnie into a professional. And so Ronnie already has this team around him, and so he's going to be going to college, but it was the same scenario. It was, Ronnie, this is where you're going to go to college. This is the best fit for you. This is the best coaching. Go take your recruiting trip. And if there's something that really isn't right, then you got to tell me. But if not, then this is your place. And boom, that was it. He took the recruiting trip. He loved it. I said, sign the papers. We're done. Now we move on. Let's continue training. So it's really, you know, I mean, when you have a team like that around you and you understand the player and what they would love to do and the management and all those things, I don't think it's that complex. But, you know, it depends who's around your child.
That's amazing. I mean, do you think a lot of other top players have this type of, you know, linkage and like where their coach like knows other college coaches and has a close relationship? I mean, is that happening to a lot of other players, do you think?
I can probably say no.
Okay.
Hopefully for a lot, but I don't think so. And because I think in America you have groups and lessons. And so, you know, it's become big money for a lot of places. They need to fill courts and pay their staff and pay the rent and all these different types of things. I don't really have to do that. It's Pierre and I, and we have our core little group of kids, and we're taking care of them, everything. So, like I said, from the tournaments to the training to their physical fitness, the whole thing is managed for them, as well as you know, the college placement. But so many times I'll be looking online and I'll see, and I may know a certain child or maybe not, but I'll look at their record and their ranking and these things, and then they'll pick certain schools. And many times I'll think that to me, that's not correct. So there's a lot of things that you have to look at for that particular individual to see if it's a good fit. Where are they going to fit into the lineup? What type of game style do they play? Should they go to more of an indoor school, an outdoor school? Do they have a potential to be a professional player? Are academics more important than the tennis, or vice versa? And are they going to fit in well with the coaching? Are they going to fit in well with the team? I mean, there's so many things that I think about for the students that I train, so that they have a great experience in college tennis and for their tennis as a student athlete and their academics. So like I said, it's imperative that your child has a good team around them and people that really understand all these different things about developing and mentally, physically, tactically, technically, college placement, all of these things, so that mistakes can be avoided. And so that's really why I said, that's why I do what I do. And to me, we either do it right or we don't do it. And that's just the way I was brought up.
Love that, Todd. Appreciate that. And so I just want to take one of the factors you mentioned just to get an idea of like your thought process. So, for example, let's take the factor of you mentioned game style. So let's say you have a kid who has who's like a grinder, for example, just like all day from the baseline. Like knowing that information, like what type of decisions or where are you led to like tend to pick in terms of schools?
Well, are we talking about just schools or then developing them and then placing them? Are we just talking about schools?
I think just schools, like, cause you mentioned like all these different factors, like fitting in with a team, this and that. And then like, you also mentioned game style. So I was wondering how that fits in.
Sure. So, I mean, most schools, they have indoor and outdoor facilities. So to me, if they went to one of those types of schools, could it transition to both outdoor and indoor? That's number one. You know, then you have to see. But in terms of if they're just a grinder, then they would probably be best fit to be going to an outdoor school, a University of Miami, a University of Florida, the California schools, Texas schools, warm weather climate type schools. But they are going to play indoor schools, even if they go to a warm weather climate. So they have to be able to transition over into being able to play maybe on a faster surface indoors. So like I said, so that's why I asked you. you know, they have to learn transition, maybe a slice backhand, maybe learn how to return better. You know, learn how to play on faster courts. So like I said, you know, each individual is different. So, you know, those are a lot of the things that I look at. You know, it's, you know, for me, the kids have to be peaking from when they're 16 to 18 years old for most likely college. You know, maybe you have a professional here and there, but most likely college. So if I have that child before 16 years old, then it's how big are they going to be? How, you know, technically, how are they, you know, the grips and the swings, how good of an athlete are they? And then what is the game that needs to be developed so that they can achieve what they would love to achieve, not only in their junior career, but end up in a type of college where they would love to be. And so then we start attacking that every single day of, you know, how to train them and the game style that they need to be playing to achieve those types of results.
Awesome. Great advice, Todd. Appreciate that. And so I'm going to ask you for another piece of advice here, which is, you know, the classic, like, I'm a college tennis player, like pretty high ranked. Should I turn pro or should I stay? Like, what advice do you have on like what to think about when you're in that situation?
Sure. Are you talking about out of junior tennis or out of college tennis?
Oh yeah, sorry. So like, say you've been playing like 1 or 2 years of college tennis, and then you're thinking, okay, oh, like maybe I can be go pro, or maybe I should stay. So, some advice for that.
So it's very simple. I mean, I can tell you what my goals were at the University of Miami. Is very simple. Is that you have to dominate. If you're going to have a realistic chance of becoming a professional player out of college tennis, you have to dominate. You probably have to be one of the top couple kids in the country, top three, top five, to have a realistic chance. For example, my goals at the University of Miami were to come in and play number one as a freshman. It was to win minimum 80% of my matches at number one and win NCAAs and become All-American. I really wanted that as a personal goal. But these were the results that you needed to have a realistic chance that Pierre and both Jay Berger thought to go to the next level and become a professional player. I was close to making the finals. I had match points in my second year at NCAAs, but I achieved all of my goals except for that one in college tennis. And so the way that I was managed and the way that I manage the kids that I train is that we don't skip any steps at all. So if you are, for example, if you are struggling to win, you know, maybe tournaments or make the finals of tournaments in the 14s, you don't play up into the 16s, right? Every single step you have to do well and prove yourself, and then you can go to the next level. And so that's the way that I was managed, and that's the way that I manage my students. There's no skipping steps. And so I did not leave college until I had those specific results to be able to have a realistic chance of becoming a professional.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, Todd. I mentioned it a couple times before. I mean, I feel like there are some juniors for sure that, you know, they haven't even won certain levels of tournaments and they're already playing like an age group up, which, you know, as you mentioned, you've got to go through really all the levels and make sure you're battle tested and can win, you know, tournaments before you take, you know, a leap, at least consistently. So that's great there. And Todd, so, I mean, you obviously had a great pro career, but I wanted to get into, you know, some of the setbacks because you, of course, went through a lot of hardships and then ended up coming back, which is fantastic to see. So I was wondering if you could take us through the eye issue that you had and, you know, when you first found out about that and then how you were able to come back from that, at least for a little bit.
Yeah, sure. So when I turned pro, I mean, like I said, my dream was to always become a professional player. And so I worked towards that from when I was 6 years old. I mean, I had it in my mind that I am going to be a pro tennis player. I'm going to train like a pro player. I have been around pros my whole life and I know how they train. I know the results you need. And I love this more than anything. I'm going to be a pro. So, you know, and we can go even before the eye problem I had. Sure. you know, when I got out of college, I really didn't have any injuries in junior tennis. I mean, maybe a minor one here and there, but nothing crazy. And so after 6 months, I was the highest ranked player coming out of college. That was the 2003 group after NCAAs. They were guys like Bobby Reynolds and Amir Delek, Rajiv Ram, Jesse Witten, guys like that. Benedict Dorsch, he was a German guy out of Baylor, who was a phenomenal player. There was UCLA had a phenomenal player, Tobias Clemens. He was great. There were a lot of great players. There were probably 20 or 30 players at that time that were in college that you knew it was just a matter of time for when they wanted to turn professional. So after my first 6 months, I was about 370 in the world. I had done well. I had won a bunch of futures and done well, and was keep. I was winning and losing against guys around 100 in the world, and so I was playing at a really good level very quickly out of college, and so I got to about 370 after my first 6 months, and then after that I actually tore my rotator cuff.
Wow!
So my father was a surgeon here in South Florida, and he always told me that, Todd, if you ever tear that rotator cuff, your tennis career is probably over. So when after 6 months, I was really stressed out thinking, man, my tennis career might be over. I've done all this my whole life and I left school and only I had 6 months on the tour and I tore a muscle, one of the four rotator cuff muscles, I tore 25%. And so when I went to go do rehab for it, the therapist didn't know if I was going to need surgery or not. So I tried rehab. And I was actually able, after 6 weeks, I was able to come back and I felt great and, wow, and my shoulder was healed. So that was like a miracle.
Jesus.
Yeah. So, you know, but to go back to how I was managed, when I left the University of Miami, I had two different colleges paid for. So when I turned pro, I wasn't risking a lot. And so Pierre had managed this, you know, thank goodness and everything, that when I turned pro and I was ready and everything, my education was paid for already. I could go back to the University of Miami for free, and they honored the scholarship. And not only that, in the state of Florida, there's also something called Florida Prepaid that your parents pay for your college for when you're an infant, and then obviously you can take that money and go to a state school in Florida and have your education paid for. So I already had two free types of colleges paid for. Wow. So the risk that I was taking was minimal, basically none, right? So I tore my rotator cuff, and that was in the beginning of 2004. I tore my hip twice on the tour. I dislocated one knee. I had to have a surgery in the other knee. And I missed the 1 year. I had to miss the French Open with a hip problem. I had to miss the Australian Open with a knee surgery. I had a dislocated knee and it was swelled up and needed to find the right doctor. And then we go to the eye problem. So in 2006, in the summer, I would play a lot of weeks, which usually my schedule was 3 weeks in a row. And then I would take the fourth week off and come home and train and regroup. But in the summer, I would play 8 straight weeks into the US Open. And so I was playing great. I was in the weekend of all the challengers I was playing and I felt really good. I was confident. And, but for some reason, my eye was getting really red, towards the end of the day and in the middle of the day. And I had worn contacts at that time. And so I didn't want to get my eye checked until I finished the US Open. So I win my first round match pretty easily in qualifying over this guy, Steve Darcis, who was a great player. Mm-hmm. He got to about 30 in the world. He won ATP titles. And so I beat him pretty handily. And then I had to play Stefan Kubek in the qualifying, which that was a top 20 player. So that's a pretty rough draw. And it rained all day long at the US Open. And they put me on at night. And the lights there are just incredible. Obviously, they're perfect. It's the U.S. Open. And I couldn't see the ball, and it was blurry. And I turned to Pierre during the match, and I said, I can't see. Mm-hmm. And so I lost quickly in, I don't know, 45 minutes or an hour. I got smoked, and I went home, and they diagnosed me that I had some cancer in my left eye. And so that was really difficult. Mm-hmm. And so for the whole rest of that 2006 season, I was putting some chemo drops in my left eye while I was still trying to play the challengers and finish the year out. And they didn't know if the growth would get bigger or hopefully it would go away. But so the growth didn't get bigger, but it didn't go away. So I had to go in for surgery at the end of 2006, unfortunately. And so they had to cut it out, and then they had to put an embryonic membrane in my eye, which is a pregnant woman's membrane, and patch it up a little bit. And so that was tough, you know, and, you know, it makes you appreciate so many great things and everything, but, you know, so it was tough, and, it was tough to recover from. But I did. And so I started training again, and I got back on the road and Pierre training me and everything for 2007. But when I came back to playing, the contact in my left eye, it would move. And so I'd be playing, and guys are serving 140 miles an hour, and all of a sudden my left eye would go a little blurry because the contact was moving. So then I had to go in. Yeah, it's crazy. So then I had to go into LASIK surgery, and that was a great success. I went to one of the best guys here in South Florida who deals with all the athletes and everything, and so I came out with 20/15, perfect, you know, better than perfect vision. So that was a success, but. You know, in total, my pro career was fun, and I was able to beat a lot of great players. In fact, players that are still playing that the viewers are seeing on TV still. But it was unfortunate that I was hampered by a lot of injuries. And so the tour is tough, and being a little bit of a smaller guy, I'm about 5'10", 5'11". I had to be in tip top physical condition. And you know, you have to work really hard, and your body can break down. I mean, that's just the reality. So that's really what happened. I had trouble getting through a full year for the 6 years that I played on the tour. I had trouble getting through one full year of being healthy. So my ranking of 200 in singles on the tour, I basically played half the events of really what I wanted to play. So that was the tough part. But when I was able to play, I was playing great tennis. I had great results in some of the ATP tournaments. I beat some great players in challengers and in ATPs. But unfortunately, my body was breaking down, and you know that's the chance that you take to try to become a great player.
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at newbalance.com.
This is NASCAR driver Tony Breidinger inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for craveable, hand-battered, cooked-to-order chicken fingers.
Chicken up.
Crispy, crinkle-cut fries.
Hot potato coming through.
Buttery Texas toast.
Toast walking.
And secret Cane's sauce.
Topping off now.
Turbocharge your chicken fingers and get them even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app.
Go, go, go!
Raising Cane's chicken fingers. One love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
For sure. I mean, it's just incredible stuff. I mean, not only a huge physical burden, but a huge mental burden, maybe even bigger. So I was wondering, you know, through all those injuries, I mean, what are, you know, maybe one or two lessons that you learned about, you know, what it takes to really to come back? Because, you know, obviously everybody gets injuries, amateurs too. And so I think it would be pretty helpful because I do get quite a few emails asking about, like, you know, recovery and all that. So any tips you can have about that or give us about that would be great.
Absolutely. So obviously I look back on my career and now that I'm training, you know, junior players, you know, I look back on maybe some of the mistakes that were made. But at the time I thought that they were the right things. Is that I can tell you that when I was super fit when I was in junior tennis, and then when I went to college tennis, the physical training and the trainer, he really didn't know a lot of what he was doing, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So I think it really broke down my body for when I became a professional player. And I was the only professional coming out of the University of Miami when I was on the team there. And so... the training that we were doing, the weightlifting and all and those types of things that you don't really see the players doing that anymore. And so I think it took a toll on my hips, my knees, my rotator cuff. And so the injuries I had were serious injuries. They weren't injuries that were, you know, that you could come back from in a week or two. I was out minimum of 3 months and then needed to train. And then you go back on the road and you're still a little rusty. You're losing some matches to guys that you didn't think you should be losing and those types of things. And then you get your act together and then you're playing well again. But you know, I think picking a proper physical trainer and them understanding the body and the mechanics of movement, and not only that, the techniques that are proper for tennis players. And I can tell you that kids that are calling me or parents that are calling me, I take a look in the assessment and there are many times things that concern me for the long-term health of their son or daughter that could potentially bring on serious injuries. And so that's a concern for me. And so, and I tell them honestly, listen, these things are going to need to be tweaked or fixed, because this is a concern that your child may have back problems from this, or elbow, wrist, or shoulder problems from some of the positions that they're in, or some of the techniques that I'm seeing. And then on top of it, when I got off the tour, I got a degree in body work. So I finished my college degree and I also got a degree in body work. So I was able to rehab and get to know a lot of the top surgeons and doctors in South Florida. So, and obviously, like I said, my father was a surgeon. He was a very well-respected surgeon in South Florida. So, that definitely interested me. And so I have a body work degree as well. And so, And I also have a team of doctors that if any of the players that I train, if they feel this or that, and I think it could be something maybe serious, they're in the office of one of my really good friends, and he works on a lot of the top athletes in South Florida, and they're seen immediately, and usually they're back training the next day or the day after. And knock on wood, over these 9 years, I've never had a kid have a serious injury ever. And so that's obviously my number one goal, is to make sure that the kids that I'm training are healthy so that they can keep training hard and keep working at their craft. But I learned a lot. You know, I learned a lot from some of the ailments that I had and the doctors that I saw and the bodywork degree that I have. And so fortunately, these kids, they're blessed. They have Pierre and I, but I also have a doctor that they can see on speed dial. Hey, I need you to see this player. I think, you know, they could have this or that. And so they're in the office immediately so they stay healthy. And then on top of it, I teach them all about recovery and nutrition and all the things that they need to be able to thrive in tennis. So, you know, we go over all the things from the stretching to the massage stick, to the foam rolling, to the ice baths, to all of these things, the nutrition, so that they can stay healthy and continue to do what they're doing.
Love it. Love it. Sounds like you have a great team, and you do have a great team around you. One thing, I guess, follow up. Yeah. When I was playing college tennis, I mean, maybe it's for a lot of universities, like we had basically one fitness coach, like handling all the sports. And so, of course, you know, it's going to be tough for them to know a ton about tennis, I guess, especially if they don't study the sports. I was wondering, what are some of the things that you did that your fitness coach or that they had you do that, you know, looking back, were maybe mistakes or like exercises that weren't necessarily productive? Because I was wondering to maybe you could point those out and some of us who are training with those types of exercises or regimens could maybe take a second thought about that.
Yeah, no problem. Well, before I speak about some of the things that I didn't think were so great, mm-hmm. fitness has to be done regularly, and it has to be done, say, let's say 5 or 6 times a week. It has to be done regularly. So if your child does it sporadically, they may get out of shape, then they may get in shape, they may get out of shape, they may get in shape. So when your child is out of shape and they want to start working hard, that's when they're actually very vulnerable to getting injured. Mm-hmm. When you're in shape and you're strong and you're fit, that's when you have less chance of being injured. So in college, the physical training was not that consistent. So that's number one. So you want to go push your body to get in shape, but your body's not used to that workload. So you're vulnerable to getting injured. So that's number one. When I was a junior, there was fitness done every single day. It was consistent. We knew exactly what I needed to work on. It wasn't 10 guys on a team. It was Todd Whittem. It was, what does this guy need to work on to be able to move faster, more agile, flexibility, stuff like that. But in college, all of a sudden we started lifting heavy. We started doing Olympic lifting. And so we were doing at times low reps. And so our bodies were looking really good, looking good for the girls and, all that kind of stuff. I feel strong. All of a sudden I'm squatting, more than I've ever done in my life. I feel good and strong and these types of things, but I was never really in great tennis shape. So that's a tough thing. And then, you're doing all this lifting and I think it took a toll on my body to start tearing muscles. And, when you're on the tour and you're traveling and you're going to different surfaces and plane flights and different beds and every single week and all these things, it's hard to keep your body not only in shape, but also healthy. Because when you're a player on the tour and especially at my level of the challenger level, you want to try to be playing probably around 30 or 35 weeks a year on the road if you can stay healthy. And that's a lot. And especially when you compare that to guys that are on the ATP tour, they're playing a fraction of that amount of events. And so they're able to take training blocks and get their bodies prepared for the Grand Slams and certain events and all those things. But guys that are trying to make it, they're out there trying to get points and get money and chasing and this and worldwide and where are they getting in each and every week. So it's a whole different ball game for guys like that. And then on top of it, they're not traveling most of the time with physios and people taking care of their bodies. They're relying on just the trainer that the tournament hired. It becomes a big expense, obviously, when you're on the road. And then you got your physio, your coach, your massage therapist. Some of them have cooks for them, all these different things that, no challenger player, unless they have really wealthy parents or there's a federation backing it, they can't afford that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense there, Todd. And so as far as the tour, I mean, there's so many pressures. And so I was wondering, how do you deal with kind of the fact that I think normal people, when they're playing, if they were playing a match, like they would probably be really occupied with the fact that if they won this round, they would make an extra few thousand bucks and like more points and this and that. So like, I mean, how are we able to deal with the pressures of that and staying afloat, like financially and all these other things?
Well, it was very difficult financially. I didn't have really a lot of money to become a professional player. So for me, it was, I had to learn as I was going. I couldn't have Pierre on the road with me every single week. Mm-hmm. So when I had the money, I'd bring him on the road. I was splitting hotel rooms, splitting rental cars, many times not having a coach, no physio. So you're trying to take care of all of these things on your own. And it makes you a disciplined, more mature person, but you're also dealing with the stresses. Mm-hmm. So you're looking at your bank account and you're thinking, oh man, I just lost thousands of dollars this week because I lost first round and my bank account is going down and I don't want to go broke. I mean, I almost went completely broke 1 year when I was injured and I had to drive to South Carolina for a money tournament to put some money in my pocket. Then I had to go to Mississippi, put a couple more $1,000 in my pocket. Then I was at Wimbledon and then I was kind of, back to breathing a little bit easier again. But yeah, there was a time where I was very stressed out and very nervous that it was over. And so it was tough, but it taught me a lot about life and how to handle stresses and pressures. But in going back to how, what you're talking about on the court, you don't think of any of those things when you're in a match. The only thing I'm thinking about is to play each and every point to the best of my ability and try to execute a game plan. And so if you're thinking about the money or the points that could happen if you win this match and those types of things, you can't focus on the task at hand. And so, you know, those are the things that professionals, you know, that they battle, especially at the challenger level, is that, you know, at any given moment or time, you know, you could be out of a job, you could be injured, you have nothing, there's no money coming in. And you know, it's very difficult. It's a very difficult lifestyle.
Yeah, an incredibly difficult lifestyle. And, you know, it's kind of going on that train of thought, Todd. I mean, did you have any sorts of pre-match routines or, you know, any sorts of protocols that you followed to also help you kind of get in the zone to where you weren't thinking of like non-essentials that wouldn't help you actually win the match?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I had routines for everything that I did. Maybe superstitions or routines, whatever you want to call them. Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, I mean, you know, I warmed up a certain way. It was done the same way every single time for many, many years. The same foods, you know, to the fluids I was drinking, to how I was stretching, taking care of my body, to, you know, before the matches, I was regripping my rackets. I was away from everyone. I was totally focused. I was in my own little zone. I was only thinking of how I was going to play the match, my game plan. I didn't have any distractions around me, nothing. It was tunnel vision the whole way. And that's how I took it. It was serious for me. I wanted to achieve some big things in my tennis career, and I was serious about it. It was not fun in games for me. So, so it was my job, and it was made very clear at a young age is that, you know, as much as I love tennis and compete and love to compete and train and do these things, it was my job. So when it's your job, you look at it differently. And so I tried to do it as professional as I could. And that's what I try to teach my students now is that, you know, is it their job? Well, they might not be earning a living at it, but they could earn phenomenal scholarships mm-hmm. that could help their parents out financially. And not only that, they could end up in the most elite schools, which I've placed many of them in such incredible schools that now they're set for phenomenal jobs when their college career ends. So is it a job? Yeah, maybe it is. I mean, you have to go about it in a very disciplined manner. And there's a lot of kids that want to be in your position. So it's competitive. And it's going to come down to results and discipline to who gets these very elite spots in these types of programs.
Yeah, for sure, Todd. I mean, you're investing your time and effort into you know, a long-term thing where you're not going to immediately get like, you know, money and stuff, but like it, you know, at one point it's all going to really explode in terms of the value will come back to you and your family and everything. In terms of the routine, you know, I hope you don't mind if I prod a little bit, but I was wondering if maybe you could either give us like maybe the specific like, routine or like, you know, an hour before the match, like what did you do? Or maybe like, what do you suggest your students do so that somebody who's listening could maybe replicate it, for their next, tournament match?
Absolutely. So, I mean, you know, depending on when I played throughout the day, whether I was playing maybe a feature night match or maybe a midday match or even a morning match, the routines kind of stayed the same. About, I would say an hour and a half before the match, I'd warm up. And I went through the same warm up every single time. Mm-hmm. I went down the middle. Mm-hmm. Then I started doing my cross courts. I finished my cross courts with down the line winners on both sides. Then I went through my volleys. I went through my overheads, mm-hmm. then did my serves, maybe hit some return to serves with my practice partner, mm-hmm. then maybe played a couple of points. And then I was done with that. Then I went to the locker room. I went into the locker room. Then I changed my clothes. Then saw the trainer, started getting stretched out by the trainer. Then, like I said, I went to a quiet place. I didn't put any music on or anything. I just wanted it very quiet. And I was regripping my rackets, getting ready. And I was thinking about the game plan that I was going to try to attempt to do in my match. And so I wanted to be as prepared as I could. I did my research on my opponent And then right before the match, I'd probably start running around and doing some sprints and getting a little sweaty before I walked out onto the court. And that was really the pre-match preparation. I mean, I also maybe ate some food depending on, you know, when in the day I was, when in the day I was going to compete. But yeah, that was the pre-match preparation and I stuck to it. You know, I was very routine oriented from a very young age, from George and Pierre. And so we stuck to same routines. Many times the workouts from training were the same. And it was very disciplined every single day. And we were working towards things and we could gauge improvement on certain things by, you know, each and every day. And that's what we did.
Love that, Todd. Thanks so much for that level of detail. And, you know, like you said, the routines really help normalize things and help you get into the right frame of mind every single time and in a comfortable place, no matter where you might be playing tournaments for the most part. Also, as far as, you know, finally, of course, retiring, I was wondering, like, how hard that decision was and how you finally came to that decision.
It was actually very easy for me to tell you the truth. For some players, it was difficult, but for me, it was actually pretty easy. At around 25, 26 years old, I felt like my legs were slowing down a little bit. And I needed to be, like I said earlier in the show, I needed to be fast and agile, and I wasn't serving 140 miles an hour. And, you know, I had a big serve. It was clocked in the 130s, but I wasn't 6 foot six and serving like that. So you're out there battling. You know, each and every point is very tough physically. And so when, you know, I said that in 2009, in the beginning of 2009, I said that, basically, if I had another major injury, I was going to stop and I was going to, you know, get off the tour and that was going to be it, because my body wasn't really telling me that I could have a very long lasting career and really get through a season health wise. So that was difficult. And quite honestly, I was getting tired of the traveling. And so I played amazing in 2009. I played some of the best tennis of my career. I had a tremendous ATP result. I beat Robbie Ginepri and Taylor Dent in the SAP ATP tournament in San Jose. They don't have it anymore, but it was a tournament that I grew up watching Andre Agassi and Pete Sampras compete in. So it was super exciting. So I qualified in and made the quarterfinals and beat those guys. So I was playing phenomenal tennis, and then I had a great tournament at Indian Wells. Also, I went there to the Masters Series, and I qualified in. I beat a guy 80 in the world. Then in my first round match, I beat another guy about 80 or 90 in the world, and then I lost a very close match to David Ferrer in the second round, where if I would have served a little bit better, there's a good chance I would have won that match. So I lost, I believe it was 6-4, 7-5 in 2 hours. And at that time, he was around top 10 in the world. So I was playing great tennis. So I played the rest of the season, and I was playing okay. And I didn't have any really great results after that for the rest of the season. And then I trained for the 2010 season to then go play the Australian Open qualifying. And after I played the Australian Open qualifying, I went to Hawaii to play the next challenger. And as I was training, I felt my hip go again. And I knew right away that, and I had torn it once before, and I felt it again. And I knew right then and there in my heart, I knew right then that it was time to stop, because, when you're fighting a lot of those injuries and you're not able to play a full season, and you're in the doctor's office or you're trying to rehab and you should be training or traveling and competing, then, you know, it's not a good thing. It's not that much fun. You're always trying to play catch up. And like I said, my legs, I felt like they were slowing down already at 25, 26 years old. And so if I needed a hip surgery to clean up some stuff in the hip, you know, you're not going to move faster. I mean, you see Andy Murray now, and he's not moving any faster. And I watched Gustavo Kuerten, and he couldn't move to his forehand side anymore. So, you know, those are really tough injuries. And so in my heart, I knew that it was time. And I was also getting tired of the travel, and I had a great fiance that was super supportive. And in fact, my family, whether it was my at that time, my future in-laws or even my mother, you know, they said, okay, you go back and you'll keep going. And in my heart, I didn't want to do it anymore. Mm-hmm. And so that's when I pulled the plug. And I think my family and maybe, you know, I'm not sure about Pierre, but my family, they thought I was going to have a surgery and go back and try to do it and keep working at it. But in my heart, I just didn't, you know, I didn't want to do it anymore. You know, it was difficult. And but, you know, the times that I had were phenomenal on the tour. I beat some great players that I wasn't even sure I could ever compete with or beat. And I was able to beat some at different times. And so that was super exciting during those moments. But it was just hard to keep the consistency going.
Sure. I mean, yeah. I mean, you knew when it was time inside and you made the best decision. And fortunately, you're healthy today. And I'm watching you, you know, play some, you know, against some really good players. Actually, I remember there was one day where I think, was it maybe Ronnie's flight didn't come in or something, and you ended up playing with somebody. Who was that again?
Yeah, that's funny. So, you know, like I said, Ronnie lives with me, and he's originally from New York. And so he was flying back from New York, but his flight got canceled. And so I felt really bad. And I was like, man, I haven't hit balls at this level in a long time. But I felt bad for Riley Opelka and Jay Berger. Sure. So I told my students, Pierre, you got the students today, and I'm driving out there, and I'm going to hit with Riley myself. And I was a little concerned. I was like, man, I haven't. And like I said, when you're out of shape, you're a lot more vulnerable to getting injured. And I was like, oh man, I'm going to go do this, but let's hope I get out of this hole. You know. But yeah, it was great. I had a great workout. Hopefully I was a great hitting partner for Riley. I've known Riley since he was about 13 or 14 years old. And wow. I know his father, they're amazing family, class act. I know Riley and Ronnie are communicating, you know, all the time. And so it's great. It's a great relationship. And so, yeah, I went out there and hit with Riley and it was great. It was fun. I wouldn't want to do it every single day anymore, you know, cause that would require me to try to get in great shape and everything. But it was good. It was fun.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah. I met Riley really briefly at a ITPA, International Tennis Performance Association, conference, Dr. Mark Kovacs, hosted. Uh-huh. And, definitely very a very nice. Cool guy. And I felt like I was 3'7", you know, standing next to him. So,
right. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Heck of a guy. But, so Todd, obviously you transitioned successfully, very successfully from a pro career to being a fantastic coach. I was wondering, you know, what inspired you to start coaching, and like, how did you come up with the business and, you know, the whole story behind that?
Sure. So when I got off the tour, I wanted to finish my college degree. I wanted to get a bodywork degree as well. And so when I got off the tour after that Australian Open in 2010, I started working at an academy here locally. Got a great offer to work there and train the best players at the academy. And so I did it for 6 months, but I didn't really enjoy it, and it wasn't for me. And so I stopped, and I had the backing to you know, really do what I wanted to do. And so I started with one boy privately, training him, and it was a big risk because I could stay at the academy and continue, you know, just working with the juniors and making good money, and I was getting paid well, but in my heart, it wasn't for me, and I didn't think it was what I should be doing. And so I actually took a big pay cut, and I started with one student, and that's a risk. That's a risk that I took. I was just getting started I had just gotten married in July of 2010. I got married, and so it was right before we got married, and so you know, I wanted to try to do something different in South Florida. I didn't want to do the cookie cutter mold, and, and I didn't want to have an academy with masses of kids. And not only that, I had tremendous mentors that were mentoring me on what I should be doing. And I had tremendous mentors my whole life. And I was blessed to be around very successful people my whole life. And so I always looked at them and I saw what they did really well. And I always thought that, if I could do things that these successful people are doing on a daily basis, whether they were doctors or attorneys or professional players or those types of things, then I could have a chance to be successful. And so, so I started with one boy who was a senior in high school. I mean, who does that? You know, that's super risky and making a lot less money than what I was making at the academy. Mm-hmm. And so, so I wanted to take that chance and try to do something different. And at that time, I was finishing my college degree and I was also getting a bodywork degree as well. So basically, you know, at that time, you're hoping that people are going to call you and you got to have results. I mean, the kids have to do well. And so I placed that one boy in college. And then when I was training that boy, a girl that had previously trained at the academy, she calls me and I had lost track of her and I trained her and she became a phenomenal player. I trained her for 1 year. She was top 10 player in the country and she played number two at Princeton.
Wow.
So that was a great success. She had the best results of her junior career. She went on to one of the best colleges. Then I had a group of four boys and one went on to play number one at University of Miami. Another one went on to play number one at Florida Atlantic here. And now he's becoming a doctor, very, very bright kid and great family. And those four boys did fantastic. And then all of a sudden I'm getting some more phone calls and I had a boy living with my family for 2 years and he went on to University of Pennsylvania to the Wharton Business School. He played number one all 4 years. I trained this kid 5-6 days a week for two straight years. And he was the only kid in University of Pennsylvania, in the tennis program, in the history of the tennis program to be all Ivy League 4 years in a row. So these kids they were not only going to phenomenal schools, but they're also playing one or two on their college tennis teams. So that opens tremendous doors. But that's why I think the training has to be really catered to that individual. And you have to spend a lot of time with these kids to be able to get the most out of them. And then they can go on to play, some great college tennis. So I've had multiple kids in the Ivy League. I've had number one players in the ACC. Ronnie is going to LSU. He's been living with me for, like I said, for over 4 years. But he was my first youngster at 12 years old that I was training that I thought was going to become a great player, and he won the Eddie Hearn 16 and under tournament coming from out of nowhere. This past April, he went to the Easter Bowl, and he's the first kid in 52 years to win the Easter Bowl 18s, beating a couple of top 20 players in the world. So that was super exciting. And then just recently, about a week or two ago, and keep in mind, he hasn't even gone to college yet. He just beat Stanford's number one player, about 2 weeks ago, which was, incredibly exciting. I was watching it on my computer. And Pierre was out there on the road with him. So he already beat Stanford's number one player and he hasn't even gone to college yet. So, the results have been great. I mean, I've had kids go to Tennessee, to Wake Forest, number one at University of Miami, number one at Wisconsin, number one at University of Pennsylvania, another boy at University of Pennsylvania. Then you got the girl that went to Princeton that played number two. So, in only 9 years, I feel like the results have been great. We've done it the right way. We've spent a lot of time with the kids. It's not a cookie cutter mold. And we've taken care of these kids. And so that gives me the most joy to get on the court every single day. I believe that if I had masses of kids and I couldn't really put my life into them and there were too many kids and I couldn't do it the right way, I wouldn't have as much joy doing it. So that's why I've kept it very small and I've kept it elite. And like I said, I've had great players and I've had players that are good players. But they've had a great mentality and a great work ethic, and they've been respectful. And so these are the kids that I love to be with every single day. And it's not that I love to be with Ronnie more than the others. Obviously, Ronnie has been the best player that I've trained. He's been in my system the longest. Any kid that brings that mentality, I love to spend my hours with them every day.
For sure. I mean, there's a lot of great lessons here. I mean, first off, I think, you know, you're brave enough to follow like what was in your heart, whether it was, you know, first deciding that you needed to retire, and then also deciding that, you know, the academy type of living or teaching wasn't for you. I mean, there's a lot of people I'm sure that they, you know, they might think that, but then, you know, just follow like the easier route, which is like staying where they are instead of potentially going with what really would make them happy in the long run. And then also just, you know, the quality of your work really speaks volumes where, you know, you produce some fantastic students, you know, and it's starting from the beginning, and then, you know, word just spread from there. Also I was curious, just a side note, didn't Ronnie have to like win or go through qualifying for one of those tournaments to win?
Sure. So yes. Yeah. So at the Easter Bowl, he had to go through qualifying in the 18 and unders, because the path that I have my students take is probably a little bit different than what a lot of the kids are doing, but I think it's the best way to develop players. And so I never had Ronnie chasing international tennis points all around the globe 20 or 30 weeks a year. I didn't think, and I still think, that is not a great way to develop a player. So you can develop a player if you have the right team, but I don't think a lot of players do that, you know, or academies do that. So you need to be, if you're going to go out and you're going to be a youngster, say 15, 16, 17 years old per se, you need to be training on the road and doing your physical fitness, and you may only be playing one match a day, or maybe you lose and you have 5 days before your next event. You need to really be working on your game really hard so that you can continue your development even though you're on the road. And that's very difficult to do. So I see a lot of kids that are traveling worldwide and doing those things. But to me, it's about development. So if you're missing that training time and the fitness and all those things, you're not becoming a better tennis player. So people were surprised that Ronnie could go out and win a tennis tournament like the Easter Bowl because he didn't have a very high ITF ranking. In fact, I believe he had only played maybe one or two ITF tournaments before that. And so he went for qualifying, and he qualified, and he starts going through the draw and beating guys he had never beaten before. Then he's beating guys top 20 in the world, and then boom, he wins a tournament. So I believe he went through 3 rounds of qualifying and then another 5 or 6 rounds in the main draw to be the only kid in 52 years to win the Easter Bowl coming through qualifying. And so that was really exciting, but it also showed that he had trained really hard and really well for years to be able to do that. And what people don't realize is that he was 17 years old, but he had already played a year and a half or 2 years of professional tennis. So was it really a big surprise that he won that tennis tournament? I don't know. Not to Pierre and I. We thought it was a great result that he could physically and mentally sustain a certain level and standard throughout that whole tournament, going through qualifying and going through the main draw. So that was really the test, was that could he sustain physically and mentally each and every day to be able to come through and take a title like that. And obviously he passed our test.
Yeah. It's a tough test there. Winning so, what, like 8-9 matches. It's just insane.
But yeah. It's exciting. No doubt about it. Very exciting.
Yeah. Super impressive for sure. And so in reading the description of Todd Whittam tennis, I noticed that it, and as you said, what you studied, you know, it concentrates in tennis coaching, of course, and then also massage and body work. And, you know, you don't see that too often as being concentrations in tennis training and whatnot. So what is it that's specifically important about massage and body work that contributes to a winning tennis player?
So, well, to make a long story short, when I got off the tour, I thought I was the guy that I send my players to. He's a very well-respected bodywork guy in the area. This man, Keith Parmenter, he's one of my really good friends, and he worked on me my last couple of years of competing on the ATP tour. I thought I was going to join him in his business. And so that's one of the reasons why I went and got a bodywork degree, was to join him in his business. I didn't know that I was going to be coaching tennis as my career. I thought it may have only been a short term thing. Mm. It ended up not so being that way. For different reasons. He's one of my great friends, and just, different things that happened in healthcare and those types of things over the years that he told me it's not a good thing. So I said, okay, no problem. So I still have my bodywork degree, and I'm licensed and insured nationally I could work on the athletes, but I actually don't. I'd rather send them to Keith, and obviously I'm on the court a lot and working with the players. But I think it's something really important that tennis coaches should have. There's probably very few, if not none, maybe worldwide that really have a degree in bodywork. I don't really know any. I think it's a great thing to have, so that you understand not only the biomechanics, but understand injury prevention and maybe kids may be sore or hurting in a specific area, and you may know whether that's maybe something serious where I need to send them to Keith right away, or it's something that they could play through. So I have a little bit of that background, and so I can, many times, determine, whether it may be serious or maybe not.
Awesome. And are there any signs that like amateur players may be able to look at and like figure out whether it's like something they could play through versus something they should stop immediately?
Well, a lot of kids, they may not know the difference between soreness and pain, mm-hmm. and how to take care of their bodies and how to recover. These are all things like we discussed previously that I have to teach them. Maybe kids come to me with cramping problems, so I have to teach them proper hydration and salt intake and minerals and those types of things. So each and every kid is different. But many times kids don't know whether it's something that they should play through or not. So, it could be a little tweak, and it could be, hopefully nothing major. Like I said, I've never had kids with any major injuries. Thank goodness, knock on wood. Mm-hmm. They've been very healthy, and obviously I have Keith that sees them immediately if there's anything that we think is maybe potentially serious. I think a lot of it is education, and a lot of it is mechanics and techniques and being physically fit and putting in the work every single day. And I think a lot of people also, what I read and I see on the internet is that people are very worried that, oh my goodness, they're training too hard and this and that. And what I can tell you is that I think many kids are under-trained and not trained the right way, which then gives them more potential to be becoming injured. I train the kids, and we Pierre and I demand a lot out of them, and they're working incredibly hard. Most kids have trouble getting through the workouts when they first start coming, or even they have trouble even getting through the assessment. You got to work hard on the body and make sure that it's strong and fit and agile, and then your chances of having issues are much less.
There you go. Now, I appreciate that, Todd. And as far as, of course, you've been coaching quite a while for several years now. Are there any, either philosophies or ways that you taught, in your early part of your coaching career that maybe you changed after, realizing that maybe something like there was a better way of doing something?
I wouldn't say that. I mean, I would say that. I mean, I haven't changed. I mean, I kind of, I'm a disciplined guy. I expect a certain standard every day. getting kids to be engaged and focused for longer periods of time than what they're accustomed to is a big part of the job. Mm-hmm. But you know, you got to be on them, and so that comes from the discipline. But if a coach isn't disciplined, he can't really instill that type of discipline in the players. So I feel like I'm very fair, and I think the kids realize that they have it really good. I mean, they basically have two private tutors and a private hitting partner every single day for them. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like they're in such a great scenario to become not only a great human being, but also a great tennis player, that I don't want them to really waste it away. And so, you know, have I learned things over these 9 years? Absolutely. I can tell you that each and every child needs to be trained differently. Mm-hmm. Based on their body type, based on their previous coaching, based on their techniques, maybe their grips, their movements, their parenting at home. There's a lot of things to look at. And then you can, once you understand the scenario, then you can go about really helping that child. But to me, the only way to really get the most out of each and every child is to really understand those things and then build a game each and every day so that they're peaking when they're 16 to 18 years old. And the only way to do that, in my opinion, is you got to be with that child every day and spend hours with them every single day and be very consistent in what you're doing and what you're working towards. And then you can see some great things.
Love it. Love it. And Todd, I mean, there's obviously several different dimensions to being a successful tennis player, you know, technique, strategy, fitness, the mental game, for example. I mean, what would you say that you generally spend the most time in, you know, between those different areas?
Sure. Well, Pierre and I probably spend our most amount of time on fixing a rocky foundation, mm-hmm. of technique, mm-hmm. movement, and mentality. Mm-hmm. Concentration, discipline. Mm-hmm. That's what we're spending our time on. Mm-hmm. And so the only way, and I can tell you this from many examples, is that, you know, whether the child is 13, 15, 16 years old, whatever the case shall be, if you want to fix a foundation that may not be the most solid foundation for a child, you need to spend a lot of time with them. Mm-hmm. And then when you can have a good foundation, then you can start talking about the strategies and the technique, you know, and the tactics, not the mm-hmm. technique, sorry, that's part right. of the foundation,
right.
you know, the strategies and the tactics, then you can start talking about that and teaching. But a lot of the parents say, my child doesn't know how to play tennis. They don't know how to construct a point. I say, I agree. But do they understand how to hit specific spots? Can they move? Do they have the discipline of being able to hit the ball the same way on the same spot, the same type of way? You know, do they have variety? You know, so many different things. And then you put them through drills and they can't do it. So the foundation is rocky technically and movement wise and maybe grips and swings and preparation of racket and you know, all these different things. So then you have to go back and fix that before you can move on to other things. And so that's what we're really doing. But if you want to fix that and do it in a very timely fashion, you have to be with those kids every single day working on those things. If not, it's not going to happen. No chance.
Gotcha, Todd. And, where do you think bad technique comes from?
It's tough to say. From the early times of the kids, you know, maybe training. It really depends on how serious the kids and the parents want to be. Just like myself, when I was 6 years old, I was coming from, I don't know, 10 or 20 kids on a court, you know, just beginner stuff. But then I got serious when I was 7 years old. And so, you know, George and Pierre started fixing my swings, my grips, my movement, my discipline of my repetition of shot every single day, all these things that, you know, you'd hope would be solid maybe by the time a young boy or girl is about maybe 12 years old, but that's not always the case. So, you know, we're fixing the foundations, you know, unfortunately, you know, past that age. And so parents want, many times they want results, but you have to fix that foundation before you can get results. And so, you know, that's, you know, that could be a little, you know, it could be tedious work every single day, but hey, how good do you want to be?
Yeah, exactly. Very wise words there. Todd, a couple more questions for you. I know we've been talking for a while, but it's really been loving it. It's tons of value. I appreciate it.
Sure.
What are three, you know, I don't know how much of a reader you are. You mentioned, you know, you're all about tennis, but what are the three books that you might gift to a friend to help them play better tennis?
Sure. You know, when I was on tour, I read some books. When times were tough, I read a sports psychology book called Mind Gym that I thought was excellent. I read both Lance Armstrong books that were very fascinating. I loved to read about athletes when I was on tour and how they maybe dealt with different, you know, maybe stresses or pressures or their upbringing. I read a book on Derek Jeter, I remember, because my family was from New York, so I grew up a New York Yankee fan. I read a book on Marion Jones, I remember. I'm trying to think what other books. I read Andre Agassi's book on the way to Australia. I remember that.
There you go.
I read Brad Gilbert's book. I did spend some hours with Brad Gilbert because I did a lot of training with Andy Roddick in South Florida. So I spent time with Brad Gilbert when he was training Andy Roddick. And so I read Brad Gilbert's book. So yeah, there were some books, yeah, that I read.
Wow, Todd, you know, for being a guy who didn't like school too much, you're a bit of a a book monster here, and I appreciate it. It's good, at least six good books there. Cool, Todd. And this is an interesting one, but if you could put a huge banner up at the U.S. Open with a quote or a slogan of your choice, what would it say?
That's a good question. Let me see here. Well, maybe like I've been saying the whole show, do it right or don't do it at all.
There you go. Love that. Todd, actually, let me ask you this first. Where I know that you clearly have like a limited core group of players, but I guess if somebody wanted to work with you, I mean, what would be the best way to get in touch?
Sure. Well, the two best ways. Well, there's a couple, you know, even more than two. I mean, like how you got in touch with me on Facebook on Messenger. Mm-hmm. People follow me and they look at my workouts and they get a good idea of kind of what Pierre and I are doing. So I try to post almost every single day or at least Monday through Friday on either Facebook and also Instagram. I do both of them. Then they can contact me at Todd, T-O-D-D, at twtennis.com. Mm-hmm. Or they can reach me on my cell phone. It's on my website as well at 954-296-5610.
Awesome. Sweet. Thanks. Everybody listening, do not prank text him. No, I'm kidding. and what's your, what are your social media handles like for Instagram and so forth?
What do you mean by that?
Oh, just your, if they wanted to search you and find your profile, like on Instagram, at least, I don't know if you're on Twitter too, but if you,
yeah, I don't use my Twitter that much. On Facebook, my personal account, which is really mostly my tennis, maybe there's a little family stuff on there, but really it's my tennis. It's just Todd Whittem. And then, my business account is Todd Whittem Tennis. So pretty easy. And then on Instagram, I strictly only do that for my tennis business, and it's Todd Whittem and then _ tennis. And, that's really how you find me on the social media.
Sweet. Awesome. Appreciate that, Todd. And, to close the show, I always ask this, this question here. What is one key tip that you can give us to help us improve our tennis games?
Good question, Mirban. I'm impressed.
Thanks.
One key thing to improve upon. Okay, I could give you a good tip here. So the way Pierre and I train our students is that we always have targets. And obviously you're trying to hit those targets. It could be in just a simple cross-court drill. And so you can gauge progress pretty easily. Mm-hmm. Is that, for example, if you could hit, say, 3 balls in a row on a target one day, maybe the following week you can maybe do 5. And then hopefully maybe another week or two later, you can do 7. And so that's how you build. You can build confidence, more repetitions. You can gauge improvement. For example, I can tell you that when I was very young, 7, 8 years old, if you could not hit 20 balls and ripping it, you know, big and heavy, 20 balls in a row with George, the drill never stopped.
Damn.
So my students look at me like I'm crazy, but that's how we were brought up. And so when I talk about having very solid foundations mentally and technically and physically, that's how we were brought up. But also keep in mind that George and Pierre were producing champions. I mean, so, you know, in any sport, that's the type of coach that you're going to need or hopefully have if you want your child to have a chance to become a champion. You're going to be trained under, you know, much different circumstances than maybe many other kids. That's just the reality.
Todd, well, I have to say, I mean, this is going to be the 115th episode now, and I have not actually had this piece of advice given about using targets. So I like it a lot, and I do appreciate it. It's kind of maybe a crazy side question, like two in the weeds, but like for targets, what are you using?
I'm just using a normal cone, you know, for soccer, that type of thing. You can pick it up, you know, Walmart or any of those types of places. But, you know, we're constantly doing that, and it gives you feedback. And then you can really see whether that particular player has maybe issues with technique, movement, preparation of racket, even mentally, how long they can stay in that drill and have stroke production and produce the same type of ball each time. So this is really, like I said, the foundation. These are things that we're working on every single day with the students in my program.
Love that. I mean, it's a metaphor for life too. You know, the more targets you can set and hit more consistently, the better you'll be doing. So, Todd, I definitely can't thank you enough. I mean, we've been chatting for a while, and, you know, time is very valuable, the most valuable thing that we have. So I really do appreciate you spending all this time with me and with us, and really appreciate it. And I have to really recognize and commend you for the fantastic job and impact that you're having on these great group of young men and women. And just keep up the great work. And thanks a lot for coming on to the podcast, and hope to meet you in person soon sometime.
Absolutely. Thanks, Mirban. I really appreciate you inviting me on. It was a great time.
Hey, anytime, Todd. Thanks so much. All right. I really hope you enjoyed my interview with Todd Whittem. Todd, really appreciate it once again for coming on to the Tennis Files podcast and spending a lot of time with me, just talking shop, talking what it takes to become and develop great tennis players and great people. Really, really fantastic chat with you there. And if you like this episode, and if you appreciate, you know, what the effort that my guests and I are putting into the show, then I really would appreciate it if you would subscribe to the Tennis Files podcast. And you can simply do that by going to Apple Podcasts or the favorite podcast app of your choice and just hitting that big juicy subscribe button. Really would appreciate that, and it would help elevate the visibility of the show. And also, it would send every single episode straight to your podcast app immediately as soon as I hit publish. Probably takes like a minute or two, but once I hit publish. But anyways, you get the idea, right? So definitely would be great and much appreciated if you could subscribe to the show. And I also, of course, want to just let you know that any links that we mentioned today on the show will be on the show notes page. I I really tried to alliterate that properly because I often mess it up by saying like show notes or something weird. But anyway, show notes page, which will be at tennisfiles.com/115 for this one. So tennisfiles.com/115. And I'd like to leave you with a quote, as I often like to do at the end of the show. And this one is a very wise one by my homie Socrates. Just kidding, we don't really know each other, but I know his teachings. And the great Socrates said, "Beware the barrenness of a busy." Oh gosh, let me say that again. "Beware the barrenness of a busy life." Very powerful quote there, really, because a lot of times we're busy doing things, but we're not really doing what we want to do, or we're not really doing things that make a big impact. You know, maybe we're practicing every single day and, oh, you know, nothing's improving. We're keeping busy, but maybe we're not really setting the intentions that we need to push ourselves forward in the areas that we need improvement. So beware the barrenness of a busy life. Thank you, Socrates. All right. Well, with that, I really do hope that you enjoyed this episode of the Tennis Files podcast. I don't know if this is the longest episode I've done. If not, it's probably pretty close. I might have broken 2 hours once or twice, but I encourage you to go through every episode and listen and find out. But no, I do. But, you know, gradually, because I think you probably have other things to do. But I really do appreciate your support and your messages. I mean, sometimes I receive, you know, DMs like the day after, the day of me publishing a podcast episode, like Aaron Patterson, who's actually been a guest too. He DM'd me and said that he really enjoyed my latest episode with Nina. And yeah, you know, it's things like that that really, really keep me going and really helps me appreciate, you know, how great you all are. And you know, I just do this for you. Of course, it's fun for me too, but a lot of work, but I love it. You know, it's tennis. What can I say? So anyways, thanks so much for listening to this episode, and I will see you on the next episode of the Tennis Files podcast. Take care, everyone.
Thanks for listening to the Tennis Files podcast. For more tips to help you improve your tennis game, visit tennisfiles.com.